Are you searching for an education that forms not just the mind, but the soul? At Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, we believe learning should be more than just getting a degree. It should be about discovering truth, beauty, and virtue. Located in the beautiful and historic Merrimack Valley, Thomas More College is a Catholic liberal arts college dedicated to the great books and the pursuit of wisdom. But here students don't just study philosophy, theology, literature, history and classical languages. They engage in lively discussions in small, close-knit classes, guided by devoted professors. And they don't just learn about faith, they live it. Through a vibrant Catholic community, daily mass, and a curriculum rooted in the teachings of the Church. Every student at Thomas More College also spends a full semester in Rome, at no extra cost beyond tuition. In the heart of Christendom, they walk the same streets as saints and scholars, study in the shadow of St. Peter's Basilica, and experience Catholic culture in a way that no textbook ever could. If you, or someone you know, is looking for an education that challenges the intellect and nourishes the soul, visit thomasmorecollege.edu to learn more. Thomas More College. Experience more. Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Lois McClatchy-Miller is a Christian activist who works for ADF. And ADF is an organisation that supports Christians who find themselves having difficulty with their rights of freedom of speech. Lois is married to Callum Miller, a doctor from Oxford, an ethicist who's been on this podcast and is himself an activist against abortion. Callum was writing on Twitter the other day and alerted his friends by saying, "My wife has been arrested in Belgium simply for holding a sign saying children are never born in a wrong body and having conversations about gender in a public place. I cannot get hold of her." Indeed, she'd been arrested by the police. Lois had gone to Belgium with a man called Billboard Chris. Billboard Chris is well known, again, to activists because he stands in public places with billboards with messages like "children cannot consent to puberty blockers" and has conversations with passers-by that are filmed as part of a way of raising awareness of these issues. However, when Lois and Billboard Chris visited Brussels, they found themselves surrounded very quickly by an antagonistic crowd who didn't want to talk through the issues, but instead wanted to close them down and began to threaten them. So they called the Belgian police, who dutifully turned up, about a dozen policemen. They set about arresting Billboard Chris and Lois and took them to prison. They held them there, strip-searched them, inflicted a number of indignities on them. And finally, with the help of some lawyers that Callum and ADF had managed to persuade to intervene with the police, they were released. The question that we all face is why the Belgian police should choose to arrest the good guys, the people who were not causing trouble, the activists who wanted to have conversations about whether children could consent to puberty blockers, rather than restrain a vicious, angry mob dressed in black that wanted to close them down. Well, to find out the answer to this and to discover more about the campaign that Billboard Chris and Lois pursue in order to bring to the public attention the issues that lie behind gender dysphoria and the medical profession's attitude to the concept of children being born in the wrong body, I asked Lois to join us to discuss what had happened in Belgium, and she's here now. Lois, it's great to talk to you, and it's extraordinarily watching the video clips I've just been looking at in preparation, where you were on the streets of Brussels. You called the police to protect you, and they arrested you. You were there with Billboard Chris, who's quite a wonderful figure, but well known to some. Would you like just to talk us through why you were there, what you were doing, and then what happened? And then I hope what we can try and do is unpack conceptually
some of the narrative so we can give it some ideological interpretation, because lots of people are floundering in the face of these enormously swift changes to our culture, which seem to have ripped away our dignity, our rights, our capacity for freedom of speech, and threaten a transformation of society that I think few people are ready for. So, first of all, you went to Belgium with Chris and a couple of placards.
Yes. Well, Chris and I both believe and know by fact that no child has ever been born in the wrong body. That this craze of telling children who are experiencing any form of distress that they might be the wrong gender or sex, and that they should take drugs and scalpels to change their bodies to find true happiness, is a myth, and a very violent and cruel one in that, leaving children at risk of lifelong infertility, heart problems, bone density issues, and a range of other mental and physical effects. This is a scourge that is happening particularly across Europe. It's something that we both feel very passionately about. Chris has spent a long time in his life campaigning on this. And so we took this message to Brussels, the heart of democracy, the home of the European Union, and we met with various legislators at the Parliament throughout the week. But we also had some time to engage in street conversations, which is Chris's best known trait, if you like. He has become fairly well known online for interviewing people, filming us, getting different reactions from the public, a lot of positive, a lot of parents especially, but many people agree and have concerns about this gender ideology being taught to our kids. And of course, some people also disagree, and we can put those debates online and spark further conversations, which is at the end of the day is the goal. We engaged this. We had been out in central Brussels for about 20 minutes. When we started to get harassed, particularly by one gentleman that we'd met previously 2 days prior. He came across, he was very aggressive. He started kind of pushing into me, pushing me back as into kind of the street. He started messing with the equipment. He was very, very aggressive and rude, shouting and swearing. I couldn't catch the full drift as it was mostly in Dutch, but I gathered that whatever he was proposing was not going to be the nicest for me. And so as this was kind of generating some attention, lots more of more people came. I think people called their friends also to get them to come down. And soon there was quite a mob around us, shouting and screaming and calling us Nazis and fascists and things, because we don't think children should be mutilated. And it was getting a little bit out of control. And so Chris asked me to call the police for our own safety, not knowing obviously at what point this might escalate into something quite nasty. So we called the police. They came, I pointed out to them the two gentlemen who had been threatening and abusive to me. These are quite big guys. The optics of it is amazing. I'm a fairly small female. And I think in any other situation, my word would have been taken at face value. But I had a big sign on me that said that children are never wrong in the born in the wrong bodies. And I think an expression of that belief may have changed things a little bit in the police's mind. They formed a kind of large barricade around us, keeping the crowd back. They gave us a choice. They said, after a lot of debate, they said, you know, we can either take the signs off and walk away, but if we refused to take the signs off, we would have to come to the police station. At this point, to sacrifice what we believed for at the hands of the mob would have really been a victory for censorship. It would have been a victory for this horrific ideology that maims and sterilized kids. So we both made a choice for ourselves. We both decided that it would not be right to remove our message. And so we were taken down to the police station, where we were arrested, handcuffed, searched, and put into prison cells.
That's quite incredible. It throws up so many questions, and I wonder if we can try and deal with them one by one. First of all, the mob, did you get a sense that this was trans rent-a-mob telling their friends that there were enemies on the streets and to come and discomfort them? Is that what it was?
I think there was both. It was hard to tell, like, in the situation. There's so many people. But I did see at the start somebody who was actually quite dressed in quite, you know, black clothing. And I saw them take pictures and kind of spending a lot of time on their phone. So I got the impression they might be calling down a few, you know, putting this into groups. Oh. Because a lot of people did come out dressed in black, which can't just be, unless Belgians wear a lot of black, it seemed to be there was some coordination. But there was also people who just saw what was going on.
In America, black is the uniform of Antifa. Are these kind of Antifa activists who keep a little black outfit in a drawer ready to take to the streets at the drop of a hat? Do we know?
I really don't know. I didn't ask any of them if they were from Antifa.
No, you can't. You wouldn't get an answer. Yeah. So the next question is, were you talking to the Belgian police in French or in English?
No, we spoke to the police in English. They were all pretty fluent. There were some interesting things that happened with the police. I work for a legal group called ADF International, and I've seen quite a lot of similar cases play out for the people that we support. And so I do know a few things about kind of what is allowed and not allowed to happen during an arrest. And they were trying to tell us that we weren't able to film the interaction with the police. And I know that this isn't true. I know that citizens are allowed to film and are in fact encouraged to. It's quite good if things were to escalate and to go to court, it's good to have a copy of what exactly was said to who for both parties to be able to reflect on. And so we said very politely, it is in fact a citizen's right to be able to film this interaction, but the police took our camera away, and I don't think that was right. They also didn't read us our rights when we were arrested. And yeah, I have a few questions and concerns about the way that the police handled the situation. They also changed our charges quite a few times throughout the night and before eventually dropping them. So, it was interesting to see it play out. And I do have some questions about what can be done about challenging that behaviour further down the road.
Was this incompetence or harassment by the police?
I think, so there was 15 police came down for us. And there was a real range. One particularly was quite rude. Others were just doing their job. Others didn't quite know what to make of it. Generally, I understand the police are kind of just, they're in a difficult situation a lot of the time. They don't know how to handle these things when they come home. I think in Belgium especially, it doesn't seem that there is a lot of public conversation, public debate about these important issues, which is why people were so shocked to see us. And I think the police probably panicked. And they did do the wrong thing ultimately. They suppressed our right to freedom of expression at the hands of a mob, whereas really they should have been dealing with those who were acting aggressively, threatening me, threatening Chris. So they did make the wrong decision.
In the video that you and Chris put up, you have an exchange of conversation where you say to each other, having spoken to the police, this is odd, because if we were protesting in favour of Gaza or environmental justice, the police would be on our side. But because we're wearing placards saying that children can't consent to puberty blockers, they're not on our side. So does this suggest that the Belgian police have had kind of training in wokery in the same way that the British police appear to be steeped in it? What's your explanation for that?
I mean, someone would have to test it out and go and have a climate sign and start climate conversations in the middle of Brussels. I did mention to the police officer who was dealing with us, I raised the point, what if we were speaking about climate change? Because he was saying that one of the charges they started to put to us is that we didn't have a permit to hold what they called a demonstration. Now, if we were having a demonstration, only two people turned up, it would have been a bit pathetic, as I pointed out. Yes. We weren't there to have a protest or a demonstration. It was just street conversations. But I did point out to him, if we were having these conversations about the environment or foreign politics, we wouldn't have asked to go and ask for permission to have those conversations. Anyone can have those conversations. Mm. And I could see the police officer had never, he didn't seem to have ever processed this or had it put to him before. And he kind of thought about it. But ultimately, there was 15 of them. And I think they all just made a decision together that we were the troublemakers, even though it was quite evident that we were the peaceful ones. And I suppose they went with the easy option to appease the mob rather than to stand up for freedom of speech.
And because conceptually, philosophically, one of the terrifying things here is that here are two adults standing for the defense of children in the face of medical negligence and aggression. And the police they can't even see that this is normatively good and moral, but are already in a state either of panic or uncertainty or of wokery, which makes them choose entirely the wrong side. I mean, that in itself is quite a shift in public perception and the notion of the power of the state and what the state thinks about things. It suggests things have moved a great deal further than one would have hoped.
Yeah, that's true. It does strike us sometimes that we are the ones saying that children should not be maimed and sterilized. And yet, I remember coming out of the jail and there was like a reaction video, or both of it, kind of ludicrous in the video, but I said, I can't believe that we're the bad guys here. We're the ones that are out here defending children, and you know, we're not even making comments at this point about like adults or different decisions that a person might make. We're literally just saying, don't give children poison that will impact their development and will change their lives forever based on the decision they've made at a young age.
So, I mean, in one sense, it justifies entirely what you and Chris were doing, because this isn't a conversation that appears to have taken place in Belgium, at least certainly not on the streets of Brussels, and one assumes almost certainly not in the media either.
Yeah, that's right. I've had the opportunity to go out with Chris to do billboarding in a few different cities now, and we always think we're in a woke city. I mean, we were in Melbourne, Australia, which is known to be one of the most kind of progressive leaning woke cities on the planet, and we got a bit of hassle, but nothing compared to this. Typically when we go out to a city, and I've done it with them in Geneva and Vienna and across Australia, most you wouldn't believe this, but the large majority of reactions are supportive, whether that's someone just giving a little thumbs up as they walk past or stopping to chat and give us their verbal support. About 9-1 it's normally support to against. But in Brussels, it was something that Chris in all his years of campaigning had never experienced. It was 4-1 who were against us, who thought that we should be able to give children these toxic puberty blockers. And when I was being kind of I wasn't attacked physically, but when they were kind of getting up in my face and pushing me back a little bit into the street, I looked around to see if there was any men who might see what was happening visually and might be able to help me. And it's happened maybe 4 or 5 times. There was one time that a dad who was with his little girl stepped in, but every other time I was looking around trying to make eye contact with anyone so they would be able to help get this man off me, and they all just shook their heads and kept watching.
What do we put this down to? Why is Brussels the home of the beast, or the epicenter of wokery? I mean, one would, you know, those of us who are critical of the European project haven't been fond of Brussels symbolically, but one would never have guessed that compared to Melbourne, it would have been such extremely different. Do you have any sense of why that should be? Why is Brussels like that? Why are the police in Brussels like that?
I lived in Brussels for a little while, quite a long time ago when I was a student. I lived there for about a year, and it is a very career-focused city. It's a city full of young people who want to get ahead in the European institutions. And for quite some time now, institutionally, there's been a set of beliefs that must be adhered to, and to progress in one's career, it's not a good idea to speak out against whatever that may be. So I think because it's such an institutionalized city, everybody kind of works for some either, you know, under the EU or the European Commission or a big bank. Perhaps there's just been locked in place for so long. They also, you know, everybody speaks a different language. They come from a different place, and yet they speak English to each other, sure, but I don't think they necessarily would all read English media. And I think Belgian media or French or Dutch media might also be a little bit more isolated than what we experience, and having lots of different opinions, you know, in America and the UK, and having lots of access to different studies and reviews, like the CAS review or the recent HHS report that came out of the USA, which exposes some of the medical risks and the hard facts that show the dangers of puberty blockers. So I think it's a little bit more isolated, and it's very career driven, and there's one way to get ahead. And I think they've lost that perspective of having conversations and debates in favour of all moving forward together in one direction, even if that direction might be wrong.
And with the aim of re-educating rather than revenge, what as a member of ADF, is your recourse against the Belgian police? Are you going to sue them for wrongful arrest and try and establish a degree of protesting precedent? Is that possible or desirable?
It's a little early. We do have a legal team that's just looking into what happened, obviously just to check about injustices that occurred, and if there was things that that were incorrect about the police's behaviour, then they should be challenged, of course, for the sake of everybody in Belgium to have that right to speak out. There was, when we were just about to be arrested and the mob was really at its peak in terms of the frenzy of swear words and abuse that were being hurled at us, I saw this one lady. I kind of thought she was an angel. She was in the mob, but she gave me a wink and a thumbs up. It just gave me the courage to keep going, really. And, you know, if that one lady, she obviously wasn't able to come out and stand with us.
Right.
But there are people in Brussels who do see through this nonsense, and they do have a right to be able to speak about it and speak to their children about it and protect them. And so we need to be able to, and whether this case is just was a moment that happened one day and at least the press coverage can get people talking, or whether there is a recourse to justice further down the road, I hope that that can be helpful to those who do want to speak about this truth.
Some of us who've seen cultural Marxism approaching as far back as the year 2000 weren't at all surprised by the phenomenon. But one of the surprises is that gender dysphoria should become the flag-carrying issue for this extraordinary new face of what threatens to be totalitarianism. I remember around about 2010 when it first began to happen, I think the percentage was something like 1.01% of the population would present themselves as suffering from what was known to be a mental illness diagnosed as a psychiatric condition of gender dysphoria.
Mm-hmm.
What's quite incredible is that 1.01% has suddenly escalated to the trauma of choice for disturbed adolescents. Do we have any rational explanation for that, or are we simply dealing with the phenomenon of a new woke religion that is particularly attracted or contoured to issues of sexual identity, however they present themselves?
Well, it's become increasingly popular for a number of reasons, and it targets the most vulnerable. If you look at the statistics that came out of the Tavistock Clinic, which shut a few years ago in the UK, you'll see that many of them were autistic. And a trend that started amongst boys wanting to be girls has now overwhelmingly become a social contagion amongst teenage girls who think that they should be boys. When I was a teenager, just over 10 years ago now, it was anorexia that we all thought that we might have. We were reading about it, speaking about it. Everybody kind of fell into thinking that they had it because it was being, that was the narrative that was kind of pushed on us through the press and through magazines. And fortunately, our teachers and our parents had the good sense to say, your body's right just the way you are. You know, you don't need to change it. We love you the way you are. And that was helpful to most of us who made it out unscathed.
Has cutting changed? There was a great deal of cutting when I was university chaplain. Is that gone?
I don't know if it's gone, but you certainly don't hear about it as much, do you? But you do see these like waves, trends of self-harm amongst young people as they go through puberty, and especially again amongst autistic children who are already struggling to fit in amongst their peers and are looking for things that are internally looking for things that might be the problem, that might be wrong with them, without understanding themselves fully or feeling loved and affirmed to be themselves. And so whether in the past, whether it was cutting or anorexia, the narrative was a way out of hope to say, you're right the way you are. But now the cultural narrative is to love bomb children and support them and raise them and elevate them if they say they might be trans. This gives them a great feeling of hope and love and affirmation for a short time.
Because it appears to be a solution, or they hope it's a solution.
It sounds like a solution, and And they might feel that suddenly everybody, they might feel like a popular child. They might be celebrated more than they used to be because they have this special status. But, you know, you can hear the stories of the many, many detransitioners, especially female detransitioners that are coming out now who went through that experience and have been completely dropped by that community because they thought that maybe they wanted to stop this. And you see that this love is not a real love. It's a love of somebody, it's a love of an ideology. And when a person decides that they might not want to be taking these drugs anymore, that person is kind of dead to them. What we should be loving is the person that was, in my view, and probably many of your listeners, who's created in the image of God, and has a soul and a unique identity that doesn't need to be changed, and that can just be affirmed. And I think that's what parents need to be doing, what schools need to be doing. But unfortunately, things have gotten off track with this social contagion that is pushed on people instead of being removed.
One of the other phenomena that we find ourselves being presented with is a dramatic growth in autism itself. Assuming we know what autism is, I'm not sure we necessarily do or how to define it or test for it. Are there any settled studies which tell us more about, if you like, the ground under our feet changing as an increase in autism takes place? Is it just appearing to take place? I mean, or is autism just, you know, the step in the chain, one step further back from gender dysphoria? Or are we finding that the diet, medicine, social norms are creating an outbreak of autism? What's the professional word on the street in terms of how autism rates have changed?
I mean, I'm certainly no expert on the field of autism, so I wouldn't want to give out any kind of information based on my expertise. But I do think, you know, it's neurodivergency certainly exists. People's brains are put together differently, and autistic minds, and there's lots of different types of autism and strands of autism as well. And of course, some people react to situations differently, their brain processes information differently, and I think that's okay. You know, I think it's good to recognize these differences and find accommodations in schools to aid learning, for example, for children who need to have a bit of extra support in the way that they learn, or who are very gifted and need support with their social skills, say. So I think it's good to recognize differences amongst people and celebrate that. But what the trans movement does is they find differences and say, no, you need to be changed. And they give it a diagnosis and a treatment or a cure, which is horrific and ends up maiming a child's body. And it does not turn them into another gender because you can't change gender. A girl who's had a double mastectomy is still a girl. She's just lost her breasts. So I think it's about whether you are aiming at celebrating and helping a child as they are, or if you're aiming to transform and change a child away from what they should be.
And of course, the tragedy always is that what they're doing is they're attacking the symptom as if it's the cause, and therefore they don't touch the cause, and they may make it worse. Let's go to the notion that what we're dealing with is not just mental instability and the sociological expression of psychological contagion, but it's become a religion. It seems that we're dealing, I think, with a world in which three major religions have emerged in competition with each other. There's Christianity, the face of the old order, the platform which our civilization in the West was built. There's Islam, of course, which we know about, and this is not a moment when we're going to pursue it in detail. But there's this other thing which has become the part of the problem is we haven't been able to settle on a proper name for it. So I've called it cultural Marxism for a long time because it seemed to me to present, at least in terms of the outcome it was searching for, which was a revolutionary change in society, but along a redistribution of power relations rather than the conflict between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie. Wokery seems to define it's simplest as a slogan. What do we mean when we talk about cultural Marxism or wokery having taken on a religious aspect? Because it presents itself as a political and existential philosophy primarily. But what stage does that tip over into into a philosophy that deserves to be called or treated as a religion.
Yeah, so it's, I think when you compare various aspects to other religions, you see that wokery has dogma that somebody must not speak against, or they might be branded a heretic. Or to blaspheme, exactly. You know, it has these cultural kind of priests like Oprah Winfrey or Dylan Mulvaney, who are the kind of leaders of the movement who must not be contradicted or challenged. It's a sad religion, actually, because it's one without forgiveness. It's one where people sometimes have this original sin and the way that they were born. So there's this kind of hierarchy of persons, kind of hierarchy of victimology. But basically, if the less victim status that you have, and according to their manual, the more of a villain that you might be. That's kind of your original sin. So if you were born white instead of black, if you were born male instead of female, for example, if you are perceived to have some advantage in society, that's kind of taken as your sin that you must kind of consistently repent for, but are never quite forgiven for. And if someone is to step out of line, those who are involved in wokeness are very, very critical, and their cancel culture is very hard to be redeemed under their regime. It's a kind of perversion of Christianity where we recognize our sinful acts are intrinsic to everybody, but we have this hope of being redeemed, not by anything that we can do personally, but because of the sacrifice that God made for us through his son. So we can see this like parallel of a distorted religion, and one that can cause deep kind of psychological harm, I suppose, when taken to its greatest extreme. But I think the expression of how that plays out is quite telling in different countries when we can compare across the world. We were discussing earlier, Gavin, I worked for a global ministry called ADF International. We take cases across the world where people have been punished for speaking out. And in Pakistan and Nigeria and other countries, this often looks like somebody who spoke out about their faith in Christianity instead of Islam and faced the death penalty, for example, just for expressing a view that's contrary to Islam. And that's all of us in the West look over and say, well, what? That's awful. We must protect freedom of speech and freedom of religion in the Middle East and in Africa. And everybody should be able to believe what they want. So we kind of understand it when we look over them over in the East. But over in the West, where wokery is kind of our dominant religion now, we still kind of have these blasphemy laws. We just call them hate speech laws. There's a politician in Finland, Päivi Räsänen, who tweeted a Bible verse in 2019, mm-hmm. And criticized her church for being involved in the Pride Parade, a legitimate opinion to have, a legitimate point of debate in society. And yet she's on criminal charges and charged under war crimes and crimes against humanity, a section of the Finnish criminal code, because she tweeted a Bible verse, again, going against the dominant religious ideology of the day. Now, I don't expect her to end up a death row. I don't think Finland have a death row. But the fact that she's being punished by the state for speaking out about her belief, which is not shared by the state, shows that we are in a kind of new age of blasphemy law over here in the West, and we should be very, very careful about the way that we apply these censorial bans on people's beliefs, especially when it comes to a kind of smaller or lesser approved of ideology.
I think what I find so difficult about this is the covert way in which it happens. It's almost as if there are sort of strata or geological layers of philosophy or thought. I want to be able to say to those who subscribe to woke religion, compare your religion to Jesus, compare your religion to Catholicism, which is the authentic religion, and see how you've chosen something distorted and minor and inferior and more dangerous. But there isn't any point at which legislatures have stood up and said, we're moving from post-Christianity to wokery. You know, this is now a formal move. There's no point at which we can challenge it, vote against it, campaign against it, and say, and compare like with like or like with unlike. But it seems we wake up one day and suddenly the whole of the police, Belgium or otherwise, believe in wokery. When did that happen? Were they being, you know, clearly in England, Stonewall have been partly responsible for the way in which retraining has covertly taken place underneath the surface. You've discovered that for 10 years, suddenly all the major institutions have had retraining from woke institutions without it being overtly agreed at all as part of the social contract. I feel as though they've snuck up on us and suddenly have jumped up from the shadows and say, "Boo! You know, you're now captured by a woke society. We may have churches, cathedrals, bishops, archbishops, and some of the, if you like, the paraphernalia of Christianity, and so forth, but actually, you've lost. This is merely decoration. The substance of society has changed to a different religion, and you are now blasphemers, and we will imprison you." It's just the shock of this taking place in a way that I wasn't able to kind of document at the time has really taken me aback.
Yeah, I think it could feel like it's quite sudden, but then when you kind of look back over the last 5 decades, you can see how this has evolved slowly but surely over time and accelerated in recent years. If you think back to the kind of sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s, that moved a feminism that used to be about achieving equal kind of value and respect for men and women. So a woman being able to work in a workplace that was designed for men, but being able to have a family as well, and finding ways that men and women could have an equal experience of life and the benefits of society without compromising who they ultimately were. But in the 60s and 70s, we saw this change in feminism to say we shouldn't just have our own stuff, but we should be able to compete against men and be almost the same as men. So if we should be able to be CEOs, like typically a man's job, we should be able to work in the city, sleep around because we get the pill and abortion. We should be able to have the same hedonistic lifestyle that any man can have without the responsibilities that women would typically have had in the past of family, marriage, being in the home, etc. And I think, unfortunately, as feminism has developed in this way that says women are just the same as men, or even better, but women have, there's no difference, that has opened the door for an interpretation that says, well, if women are just the same as men, then a man could be a woman. We have the biology technology now to change people's genitals and to perform surgery. So if there's no difference between the sexes, why does it matter if a man wants to go into a woman's very precious shelter or bathroom or prison cell or whatever it is? And feminists are very taken aback by this argument because they don't like it when biological males today seek to take those women's spaces and what's traditionally understood as women's rights. But you can see this disintegration of understanding between what men and women are and the differences and the complementary differences of equal value, but not being the same, has opened the door to this kind of strange new era of thinking that all humanity is so fungible that anyone can just put on lipstick and a skirt and call themselves a woman. So maybe that was a little bit extra too detailed for the conversation, but I do think it's important to track throughout the last few decades how we've got to where we are today, and we can start kind of picking back some of those layers and figure out where we originally were setting our sights wrong and getting back to that place.
The answer can only be Catholicism. You can only rescue one religion with another, with a better one. And as you rightly said earlier on, this is a distortive, parasitical religion. It's actually a bit like Protestantism. It's taken the Christian religion and then distorted it into a kind of an alternative. Obviously, ADF sets out to use a legal framework of human rights to defend Christians from persecution. Do you have a sense that the only way through this is a new evangelization, a degree of courage to say to both the other two major religions, Islam and Wokery, we have something better for the human person than you do?
Yeah, I mean, as an evangelical, we'd probably nuance our explanations in a slightly different way. But I would accept the Catholicism with a small c. I call myself Catholic and Reformed. As a general principle, yes, I think the only answer ultimately to society's ailments is Jesus. I worry greatly about a right without Christ just as much as I worry about a left without Christ. I think a society which we live in today, which does not prioritize the things that enable a human to flourish, to live together in community, to have family, to be able to get married and have children and build a life together. These things in our culture and our political culture have been pushed away. Churches have never had less support in the United Kingdom. We saw that during COVID, they were considered so unimportant, they were closed straight away, even compared to liquor stores and bicycle shops and other things. And so that erosion of what the soul needs, of what people need to thrive in favour of promoting a very hedonistic lifestyle, very kind of GDP driven over quality of life, or in terms of just quality of the soul being able to connect with God. I think that's definitely a grave ailment that fails us today and how and erodes our understanding of even how we can put those building blocks together to improve society.
There are places throughout the world where Christianity is erupting, both in evangelical terms and in Catholic terms. Do you see the struggle in the West as lost, or is there some hope for a re-evangelization of the West?
Well, if you think back to ancient Rome, which I know a lot of young men today are quite worried about, or quite obsessed with talking about ancient Rome, but that was a society where they threw baby girls on rubbish heaps because they devalued personhood so much that they would just discard children that they didn't want. It was rife with prostitution, with sexual abuse, slavery, all the worst things that one could imagine to be crippling society, much like as we can imagine as we look around today and we see Lily Phillips and Glenn Greenwald and all these horrific scandals break out across our world. Ancient Rome had all that and more. But it was Christianity that came in and established a new ethic of human value, of an equal sense of human dignity, whether someone is male or female, slave or free, and established the human rights that we cling on to so dearly today. And so if that society, we're not in a we're in a difficult moment of history, but we're not in something that has never seen before. If ancient societies that were sinful and disgusting can find hope again and be rescued by a God, that's the same God that exists today. And he's no less powerful than he ever was. And so, of course, there's hope. But I do, we see throughout history that there are struggles, there are difficult times, and the remnant remain faithful. And we can pray and hope and work continuously to encourage this message of truth to be spread again.
Well, and I'm particularly convinced by the diagnosis that we're facing a new paganism in the form of wokery. And it was the Roman Empire was a pagan empire too. So I'm sure you're right about that. Tell us about ADF, what it does, what state it's in at the moment, with an increasingly large number of clients calling upon it for help.
That's right. Yes. Never been busier, actually. So ADF International is a global legal organization that works to support everybody's right to live and speak the truth. So in the UK, that has been particularly focused in recent years on protecting people's rights to pray silently. There's been several clients of ours that have been arrested, prosecuted, convicted even for just praying silently in their heads about the issue of abortion. You're an abortion clinic. So that's particularly been something we've been focused on in the UK, but we have a network of 4,000 lawyers across the world who are working on similar issues in all sorts of forms that they arise in different contexts, whether that's in Europe and people being censored for sharing important information online, in Mexico, where people were convicted of gender-based political violence just for speaking out against men taking women's places in Parliament, or of course across the Middle East and Africa, where people are put on death row just for expressing their faith. So we work tirelessly around the world to try and defend everybody's right. And if people would like to know more or to support us in that work, it's adfinternational.org.
Lois, lastly, what took you into it? How did you find your way to work for ADF as a career?
Yeah, I was always kind of interested in this meaning of Christianity and politics and how we can make our society better. And I did some of ADF International's training programs as a young person. They still exist today, and it really inspired me this new vision for society. And I was able to ask questions from experts and get to know the topic pretty well. And I studied a master's degree in human rights law. I looked specifically at the issues of surrogacy, which is quite a hot topic today, And as I was looking at that rights, that defending that right of children not to be sold as a form of surrogacy, I looked more and more into that worth of every human person to have their right to life protected, but also their right to speak and to believe and to express everything that it is to be human. So I think that was a big turning point for me. And now I've been working with ADF International for almost 7 years and counting. So it's been quite a journey, but an exciting one.
Well, on behalf of the rest of us, thank you for taking the struggle onto the streets of Belgium and being able to risk being arrested. Thanks to Billboard, Chris, too. And thank you very, very much indeed for coming to talk with us today and explain what lies behind it. And holy luck and Godspeed with everything you do in the future.
Thank you so much. It's been great to chat.
Thank you.